When Jesus says that he is the way, the truth, and the life, does he mean the only way, truth, and life? I answer that question in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In our Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor Christopher Neuendorf writes about his journey into Lutheranism from Greek Orthodoxy. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
It is written by Alito, who's a very clear and engaging writer, and it's masterful. I mean, it seems like maybe he's been writing it for years, if not decades.
I think that you would be a complete and total fool for seeing Moss as a champion for any particular set of values that you think is going to restore America to whatever status of ordered liberty and cultural health that you think we should have.
Our justification must come from outside us. It must come from the highest and most definitive authority, Jesus Christ.
What is Lutheranism? Lutheranism is the Church Catholic purged of those medieval errors that did arise in the Church in many ways, but did not destroy the Church by any means.
Air Force officers on their morning walk enjoy Issues Etc.
National Public Radio has a story, When Does Life Begin? Religions Don't Agree. A lot of opinions in the story. There is one fact. They do interview someone who says, it's Ryan Anderson, by the way, a regular guest on the program, who says it's a biological fact. Life begins at conception. Now, it is often raised that, well, this whole question of when life begins is a religious, and by the way, an unsettled religious question, and the government has no business getting into things like when life begins, even though the Roe Court, by the way, decided that life begins at some point. So, which is it? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Monday afternoon, May the 9th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about religious teachings on when life begins. Pastor Michael Samalink will be our guest of Lutherans for Life. We'll spend some time with executive editor of The Federalist, Joy Pullman, talking about children and internet access. Josh Pauling joins us to discuss Theodore Roosevelt's speech, The Man in the Arena. And then Lyman Stone will be alongside. We'll discuss the happiness of stay-at-home moms. It is assumed that they are miserable. He says the data says differently. Joining us to discuss religious teachings on when life begins, Pastor Michael Samalink. He's director of Lutherans for Life. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you very much. I am delighted to be here today and talk about these very important matters.
Why do pro-lifers focus on the question of when life begins?
Well, Pastor, I think that is the central question of the debate over the sanctity of life and abortion. Scott Kinzendorf, who's a very famous pro-life apologist, put it this way, and I think it's very memorable and easy to understand. It cuts to the heart of the issue. If the unborn is not a human being, then no justification for abortion is necessary. In other words, if we're talking about a part of my body, like my hair or my fingernails, then there's no need to have moral discussions or make laws about what I do with those, so long as it's not impacting anyone else's body. But Klusendorf goes on to say, if the unborn is a human being, then no justification for abortion is sufficient. In other words, if we are talking about a human life, then there's no excuse that we can come up with that's going to be good enough for ending that life of a judicially innocent human being. So it really is the heart of the matter, and it cuts through a lot of the emotional baggage and other questions, political issues, or issues of personal choice that are raised about it. So we feel that that's very important.
How do you explain the divergent religious opinions on when life begins?
Well, different religions have different points of departure, different priorities. I do suspect, though, that at least amongst the major world religions, the divergence is not as great as is advertised. So you're going to find culturally and religiously conservative adherents of all of those religions, whether we're talking about Christianity, of course, but also Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism. All of those major world religions on the conservative side do have a history of defending the sanctity of unborn life, simply because I think that the truth is self-evident that we're talking about a human being, one of us, a member of our race. And any religion worth its salt is interested in defining those relationships of what makes those things important.
Abortion supporters like to say that the beginning of life is an unsettled religious question, even an exclusively religious question, which science cannot even touch upon. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's a red herring, and there's really two ways to respond to that. And the first is the question of when life begins actually is not a religious question. That's what biology is all about, defining for us what constitutes life and what doesn't. We can remember from our grade school biology classes, right, that there are four commonly accepted criteria that define something as living over against something that's non-living. So a living thing will undergo respiration, will grow or reproduce, will metabolize its own energy from raw materials, and will respond to stimuli. And all of those are self-evidently true about unborn human beings from the moment of fertilization, from the time that we're embryos. We are all undergoing those processes that define something as living. So there is really no dispute. That's a scientific fact. To borrow the modern parlance, we might say it is settled science. I don't know that that's enough to end the debate, just to say that something is living. As I mentioned before, hair, fingernails, those are living cells as well. They're also human, just like embryos are from the moment of fertilization. They have human DNA. They can't be classified as any other kind of creature. They're not a frog, they're not a dog, they're not a log, but simply a human being. So scientifically speaking, before we even appeal to any scriptures or any faith, we're talking about something that's living and human. The real distinguishing factor, though, is that every embryo is also a being, a living human being, rather than just being part of another being. And the scientific term for an independent being is an organism, and there are actually criteria that scientists and embryologists use to determine whether something is an organism or is just part of another organism, right? Like part of my body. An independent organism will coordinate all of its functions towards the good of the whole. Independent organism will be able to repair damage rather than just growing bigger. It can replace the parts. It can allocate resources where they are needed most. It can adapt to its environment. All of those are things that qualify something as an organism. So speaking just scientifically, the embryo, the unborn human from the moment of fertilization, is in fact a living human being. But even if that were not the case, if we were talking about a situation where there were genuinely divergent, valid opinions about when human life begins, my question would be, why wouldn't we err on the side of caution? Let me give kind of an illustration or an analogy. If you and I were driving down the road and it was dusk and I was at the wheel and you're in the passenger seat and I looked maybe 400 yards down the road and I said, there's a lump in the road. It looks like somebody left a trash bag. Wouldn't it be fun if I just floored it and we ran over that trash bag as fast as we could and we scattered trash everywhere? And you said, you know, to my eyes, that kind of looks like it might be a person who's hurt. Maybe we should slow down. Which one of us would be the more reasonable, right? If we don't know, if we genuinely can't tell, and there's legitimate debate about whether or not the unborn is a living human being, shouldn't we err on the side of caution because human life is that valuable? So that's kind of how we respond to that red herring objection that says we're really talking about a religious debate here.
Some assert that historically Christians themselves have given many answers to when life begins. Is this true?
Well, there have been a lot of Christians in history. And so historically, Christians, speaking broadly, have given a lot of different answers to a lot of different questions. The truth of Christian history is that throughout that history, there has been a significant consensus from the very beginning about the sanctity of human life in the womb. For example, one of the earliest Christian documents written about the same time as the Bible, but for various reasons didn't make it into the Bible as part of the canon of scriptures, a document called the Didache, or the Teachings of the 12 Apostles, and it claims to have been written by the apostles, and it's been dated to about the same time that the apostles or their successors lived. And that document explicitly states in no uncertain terms that it is sinful to undergo an abortion or to seek to end the life of a child before that child is born. Now, that's not a scriptural statement, but it does represent the thinking of the early Christian community. And we can find similar statements confirming that in every generation of Christianity from that point right up until the present day, if we're talking about the early church and the church fathers or the medieval church or even the Reformation church or even since that time. Christians have been largely unanimous on the question of the value of human life. So I would suggest that somebody who says that Christians have given a variety of answers might be being disingenuous. We should study history and see what traditional Orthodox Christianity has given as an answer to that question, and then determine whether the particular objection in question is one that comes from the fringe or the extreme.
How do you respond to the argument that opposition to abortion is grounded in religious thinking, and that therefore the government has no business imposing the religious views of some on everyone?
Well, that's sort of a two-part question, right? It is true that Christians are not interested in the government legislating belief in the gospel of Jesus Christ. We don't want to mix those two things together because the gospel is a gift. It is a message of freedom, and we don't want to force people into that against their will. I'm not sure that Christians necessarily are as committed to the bright line separation of church and state as it is commonly understood in our culture today, but there is some overlap there. And we do live in a land that has enshrined a distance between legislating religion and legislating our public life and our common good together. The truth is, for a lot of us, our opposition to abortion is motivated by our religious and doctrinal convictions. That doesn't mean, though, that it can't also be motivated and informed by other matters, such as science, clear reason, the common good, the defense of the weakest among us. The truth is, the government is in the business of legislating morality, right? Any laws that are put in place, by definition, identify what is right and what is wrong. So it's not as if the government passes policies that are somehow morally neutral. But beyond that, if we're going to have any common life together at all, and this is people of a broad spectrum of persuasions, whether they're believers, unbelievers, Christians, some other religion, if we're going to have any kind of life together in which we share the same space, we're going to need to agree on some guidelines, some ground rules, and that's what government is all about. And for my money, if the government's going to make laws, the very first law should be you can't harm somebody just because they're weaker than you and get away with it. And I think most folks, just appealing to common sense, would come to a similar conclusion. So the truth is, in the life-affirming movement in the United States, most folks are actually motivated by the common good. So we don't want to live in a land where the people in power have the right to dispose of the most vulnerable, but also the conclusions of science, which is kind of a common language that we speak together. And there's a lot of mountains of evidence that widespread abortion access is actually bad public policy. So sociological evidence about its effects on communities. Certainly there's lots of medical evidence about its effects on those who undergo abortion, both its emotional and psychological and its physical after effects. It's not just that religions define abortion as sin. It's also that research defines it as bad public policy.
Finally, a recent National Public Radio story on the issue of when life begins and its religious implications did a lot of polling, a lot of saying, well, this is what some Catholics believe, but other Catholics poll this way. Why are polls irrelevant to the question of when life begins?
Well, first of all, polls are notoriously unreliable, and you can get different results, different data results, based on changing a word here or there. And so this goes back and forth as it has for the last 50 years. What genuinely is the public opinion about access to abortion? What we find is that no matter how you word things, it tends to be split about 50-50. But I think, as you indicate, rights and wrongs, morality should not be decided by majority. The popular opinion can't establish what is right or wrong. That's why we have a common language like science, like biology, like logic, to which we can all appeal no matter what our emotional investments or backgrounds are, and come to conclusions that are acceptable and applicable to all of us. You know, there was a time in United States history where slavery was popular to the majority, and I don't think anybody today would argue that because of that, that's how we should legislate. So it's kind of a fallacy and a weak argument, as almost all of the arguments in favor of imposed abortion access are. The good news is, given the Supreme Court leak earlier this week, it appears that the United States, at least in this, on the federal level, is moving more towards having its public policies actually be in agreement with and conformity to the conclusions of science. So we'd celebrate that. That doesn't mean, of course, that abortion is automatically going to come to an end, or even that it will be illegal everywhere. So our work continues as gospel-motivated voices for life, because what matters most is the person right in front of us. Even more than changing laws, we are interested in changing hearts and saving lives. And we believe that the gospel of Jesus Christ is the best means to accomplishing that.
Pastor Michael Salmanek is director of Lutherans for Life. You'll find a link to Lutherans for Life on the Talk on Demand Archives page at issuesetc.org. Pastor, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Todd.
Joy Bowman joins us after the break. We're going to be talking with her about children and internet access. She has written a recent column, "Parents Should Never Let Children Have Unsupervised Internet Access, Period," and that means no cell phone. Stay tuned.
You can call it what you like. I call it life.
Issues Etc. guests are frequent contributors to the Lutheran Witness magazine. The Lutheran Witness is a must-have resource for every Issues Etc. listener. You can receive an annual print and digital subscription for less than $20. Learn more at cph.org/witness or by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Interpreting the world from a Lutheran perspective, the Lutheran Witness magazine. cph.org/witness or 1-800-325-3040.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
With the oldest deaconess program of the LCMS, Concordia University Chicago has fully certified young women for the deaconess vocation for more than 40 years. I'm Deaconess Kristen Wasilak, Program Director for Deaconess Studies. Help us identify the next generation of servants to care for souls, engage our communities in mercy, and teach God's Word. Learn more about Concordia Chicago's Deaconess Program today at cuchicago.edu, cuchicago.edu.
And when he had said these things, as they were looking on, he was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight. And so Jesus ascended into the heavens and began his session, his sitting at the right hand of God. What does ascension mean for the church? Well, if you've ever wondered that question, you need to pick up your copy of the May issue of the Lutheran Witness, where you'll hear all about how, by his ascension, he brings gifts to men. To order your copy, visit cph.org/witness or visit our website, witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.